The goal of our lives today in the 21st century is that of personal fulfillment. But is that what the Bible teaches? Shouldn't our goal as Christians be wisdom, be understanding, be faith, be belief, be trust?
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
A couple of weeks ago now, Jack, the Study Center, did their annual Oktoberfest. And the topic was spirituality in the 21st century. I was talking to somebody immediately after the conference, which I didn't end up getting to go to. And she said, you know, I was asking her about your talks. And she said, you know, sometimes Jack has moments. And this was one of his moments. He did a really good job. He was really clear and had a lot to share. And so I'm really excited to continue to talk about this subject of spirituality. I think it's a much misunderstood one and a one that really does need to be understood better. So this is second in our series of looking at the area of spirituality, and I don't know how many we're going to end up with. What do you think, Jack?
I won't even guess.
You won't, because you're always wrong, aren't
yeah.
you? Yeah. For you listening audience, that kind
I always
of,
guess one.
Yeah. Jack always says to me, well, Christine, I'll talk about this issue, but I don't think I have much to say. And, you know, 10 weeks later, there's still things to say. So I think that will be possible here once again.
Yeah.
But before we start, I'd like to say that tapes are available from Mackenzie Study Center at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403.
Yeah, right.
That address is given again at the end of the program for those of you that didn't get it, but I think the tapes on spirituality are well worth getting. From my own experience, Jack, working with people who have been embroiled in an idea of spirituality that doesn't really match up to the biblical worldview, tend to be in a terrible jail where they're tied up in knots. And I think that understanding this concept of spirituality, a biblical concept of spirituality, can really get people out of a lot of shackles.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do.
So, Jack, real briefly, will you go back and give us a brief overview of what we talked about last time? I think that might be helpful. We were looking at what spirituality is from a historical perspective,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think we necessarily need to go back to that.
Right.
But then we went to contrasting the difference between what you call biblical Christianity and folk Christianity,
mm-hmm.
and that would be F-O-L-K.
Right, yes.
So could you define those and talk about that, where
okay.
we've already gone?
Okay. Yeah, I suggested that in terms of the goal, maybe I should define spirituality. Spirituality, as I understand it, is just the belief system, the value system, the exercises, the routines, the practices, the sacraments, and the institutions that we embrace as a kind of coherent whole. And that we embrace that coherent whole of those things in order to try to be related to the spiritual forces, whatever we conceive of those as being, rightly related to those in such a way that we can affect those so that they can transform my ordinary mundane experience. That's spirituality. Whether we're talking about Hindu spirituality or New Age spirituality or Oprah Winfrey spirituality or biblical Christian spirituality, what we're talking about is just that whole complex of ideas and perceptions and attitudes and the practices and exercises and routines and institutions that follow from them. That's spirituality.
Okay, it's something that one way or the other transcends, and I think transcends is a very big word here, my ordinary everyday experience.
Right.
It kind of brings me beyond what's physical, what's tangible. We all define it in rather different ways, But it's more than what is physical.
Right.
I think we would say, and it transcends that everyday experience and the physicality and tangible nature of our world that has an impact, though, on my experience.
Right, exactly.
That's so, exactly, because those are notes that I took from last time, Jack.
So biblical spirituality, then, of course, is the biblical view of reality, who God is, who I am, what the universe is, my beliefs about that, my perceptions about that, the attitudes that are recommended to us by the Bible, and if there are any, and we'll talk about that, the practices, the exercises, the sacraments, and the institutions that somehow follow, that I should be involved in and that I should engage in order to be rightly related to the relevant spiritual force or forces.
You say relevant, the one that's relevant, the one that I have
that I perceive
to.
As relevant, yeah. In biblical Christianity, of course, it's just God, period. I mean, there is no other relevant spiritual force. But in other worldviews, it may not be God, it may have nothing to do with God. It's whatever I perceive to be the relevant spiritual forces. What is the goal of biblical spirituality? That's what is, we talked about this last week, is so distinctive about it. The goal of biblical spirituality is not my ultimate fulfillment. Ultimately, that's the ultimate goal, but in the biblical scheme of things, I will not ultimately be fulfilled here and now in this lifetime. My ultimate fulfillment will only be achieved when I leave this age and I become a citizen in the kingdom of God in the age to come. There and there only will I experience true life.
Complete
life with a capital L, complete fulfillment. Yeah.
And I think the way people say it a lot is, if I come to Christ, then I'm going to be happy. I'm going to feel better. That's kind of the key or the answer to life. And what you're saying is that's the worldview of other religious systems, that other religious systems.
And other spiritualities. Yeah.
Yeah. But that is not the goal of biblical spirituality.
Exactly. But it is the goal, the perceived goal of what I'm calling folk Christianity. That folk Christianity is more like the other spiritualities of the world. And the only one that's really radically different is the biblical perspective, what I'm calling biblical spirituality. Folk Christianity does see, and you and I were both trained in it. We were raised up in it.
Pretty
the expectation
much.
We had is, I mean, how many times did we go to some kind of youth meeting or church meeting or evangelistic meeting where basically the message was, come to Jesus and he'll make you happy. Your life is empty, come to Jesus and he will fill it up. Well, notice how never do you have the apostles making that appeal.
Yeah, but when you say that, because of my history, I just have this lurch in my stomach that says, what do you mean? That's
right.
Not a valid understanding of Christianity.
Right.
And I think a lot of people who are listening may have that same lurch in their stomach. And I'd encourage you guys just stick with this, because I think what we have to say, I think in particular what Jack has to say about this, may, again, be very eye-opening to you, very freeing to you. So hang in there and give us a chance to try and unwrap some of what we're talking about here, because at face value, it looks really wrong. What you're saying looks really wrong.
Yeah, and I'm sure it does, yeah. Maybe one way to get at it would be if you look at the book of Ecclesiastes, where it says, emptiness, emptiness, all is emptiness. Out of our folk Christian perspective, we tend to look at the book of Ecclesiastes and say, what is that message? What is the message of that book? Well, the message of that book is that if you're not a Christian, life is really empty. But come to Jesus and all that will change. Well, if you look at it more carefully, that's not the message of that book. The message of that book is not, if you're not a Christian, here's life experience. The message of that book is, if you're a human being, here's what your experience is. It's life under the sun that is emptiness, emptiness, nothing but emptiness. And the conclusion of the book then is, so what are we going to do about it? And it's to love God and keep his commandments. It doesn't really dwell on why you should love God and keep his commandments, that's all that's left for you to do. I think the rest of the Bible fills that out pretty well, though, and that is the reason that's the right response to this empty, hollow life that we live is because this empty, hollow life we live under the sun is not really what I was made for. I was made for a whole nother dimension to my existence. I was made for life in eternity, in the age to come, but I won't I won't get that. I will never get there if I am not rightly related to God and learning to love Him and be grateful to Him and honor Him and be the right sort of person who is going to have an inheritance in the kingdom of God. So the
so biblical, ultimate fulfillment, the biblical understanding of our fulfillment here and now is that it's very limited.
Exactly.
It's not that there's nothing very substantive about what I can get here, because being rightly related to God is a very substantive thing. Mm-hmm. It's in its own sense, it's very fulfilling because it gives me an understanding of reality, of truth. And that gives me a foundation to stand on, to see life through, to understand how to make choices. And that's a really good thing, Jack. Also, there's a lot of joy in understanding the real meaning of, I think last time we met, you were talking about looking at the redwoods and being awed by the beauty of them. It gives us an understanding that God made them, and He's big and awesome and creative. It helps us understand creation in a completely different way. That does, in a big sense, fill our souls.
Right.
But the lack of fulfillment, if I go on and define that for
sure,
a moment?
Sure, yeah, please.
Is that I find myself, if I'm really looking at myself honestly, I see myself to be not just a person who is spiritual and sins sometimes, but a person who is the very core of the fabric of my being, is full of wrongdoing, is full of envy, is full of self-righteousness, is full of hurtfulness toward other people, is full of selfishness, is full of laziness, is full of choosing to be dishonesty when I could be honest. It's very, very self-serving kind of person that I am. If I really look and look and look deeply at myself and then look deeply at the world around me. When I see that, it's all of a sudden not very fulfilling because I'm not a person who can truly be full of the benefits of being a completely loving person as Jesus was. Certainly, He was living in this world, which was very difficult, and yet He must have had a heart and soul of fulfillment because He was living completely in right relationship to God. That's what the future life is going to be like for us. But there's kind of two sides here.
Right.
And part of full Christianity, I think, keeps me, or kept me, from looking at the reality of my own hurtful heart. I was so invested in needing to look like a good person in order to be acceptable to God that I had to overlook the reality of my heart. And that's what kept me in jail. That's what kept me in shackles. And kept me thinking that I was doing it good, and yet having a sense of myself that something was wrong. What I had actually become was a person that was dishonest and deceived and being deceptive to other people.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think anybody would have said that of me, or not very many people. I had a couple of people that were very close in my life who saw the reality of my life and hated it. And I think I've talked about a particular person in my life before who still hates me for that. They found it so full of stench that they still make me an 18-year-old when I'm getting up to 48.
And there's another dimension as well, and that is just death and decay itself. I mean, even if we didn't have sin, which is a big, huge hole in our existence, but even if we didn't have that, just this world we live in is frustrating because it promises so much, and yet none of it can last, and none of it does last. It fades. The Bible talks about the fading glory of things a lot. There's just not this permanent, lasting substance to things. There's just all this little bubbles of promise that just pop on us all the time.
Like what?
Well, like Ecclesiastes talks about a person making some kind of noble effort to leave an inheritance to their children, for example, and they work hard and they amass some possessions and they pass them on to their children, but they have no control and the children just fritter it away and lose it all. And that Ecclesiastes it talks about the futility of that. Wow, what was the point? Why did you work so hard when there was no guarantee that it was going to be used wisely and prudently in the end anyway and be anything lasting and permanent beyond your death? And Ecclesiastes talks a lot about just the finality of death and how it kind of nullifies everything. All the honors and glory that we can get in this world, but when you're dead, what's the point? You know, who cares? And I see it even quite apart from death, if you just think about the ecstasy of your team winning the World Series or winning the Super Bowl or whatever, and if you're like me, 6 months later you're asking, now who won the World Series this year? Oh, I can't remember.
Or even when it was your daughter who won the soccer series for the state of Oregon, and it was really great. I don't know if they did or not, but it was really great at the time. And even that, does it fade?
Yeah, it fades, absolutely.
It moves on. There's something
else. Week later, it doesn't really matter anymore.
Nobody really cares. In
no
the
one
moment,
really cares.
It feels really great.
Right.
And also, as a young person, I remember being in such, my body working so well for me in so many different ways, and there's just kind of this feeling of autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
And now I don't have that. Certainly I'm in pretty great shape, and I'm certainly not
invalid.
Old and fat and invalid. But still I see this fading glory of my own body, and that mm-hmm. it can't work for me. I'm not as autonomous as I used to be. And so even that fulfillment of being able to be young and vibrant, it goes away. I certainly notice that even with energy. And so is that kind of mundane thing, the kind
exactly.
of thing that you're talking about?
Exactly, absolutely.
It's what used to be very fulfilling isn't so fulfilling anymore. Silly things. I want to make this every day so people get it. I remember I used to really like to shop, and I know that's a really worldly kind of thing, but it's just something I enjoy doing. And there was some amount of fulfillment to that. There just simply isn't any fulfillment to that to me anymore. I just want to get out of the store. Mm-hmm. If somebody else could buy it for me,
mm-hmm.
That would be great. In part, it's because I've learned that when I buy stuff, it doesn't end up making me feel very much better. In fact, I have a super disappointment in it if I kind of build myself up to really wanting something and I get it. And it just isn't really that great anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So these things that I used to use to fulfill myself just don't anymore.
Yep.
Am I on the right track, Jack?
Yeah, absolutely. And we go one of two ways. Either we become just cynical and jaded and cranky as we get older because we see all these things that have faded on us, all these things that promised so much but they just didn't come through for us, or we become wiser, that we see through them, beyond them, to recognize that my real fulfillment lies somewhere else.
That so hits home for me. I am thinking of a person that I really love who I call this person the walking dead, because they have looked to the fulfillment of this world wanting better and better and more and trying to grasp something that will fulfill them. And what they say to me now that they're in their 70s is, and this is all I have?
Mm-hmm.
This is old age, this awful existence, This is the
sum of it.
This is the sum of it. This is the crown that I get at the end. This is not fair. And they're very, very bitter toward life and toward the world. And that is just the saddest thing. My heart just aches for them because what they have been left with is just a sense of despair.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's exactly what Ecclesiastes is talking about. And that reality, you look at the examples that we've been talking about, that reality is no different for believers than for unbelievers. That this world, the stuff under the sun, has not satisfied us. It's not that you add Jesus to it and it somehow transforms my physical strength or shopping or
winning the World Series.
Or winning the World Series or whatever. It's not that all we need is a dash of Jesus and he transforms everything into a satisfying experience. No, he leaves everything just as hollow and empty as it is, but he promises that we are rightly related to the God who has promised us fulfillment later. And that's what the good news is, not that Jesus transforms this ordinary experience.
Well, but he does transform it in the sense that, because I have lost my, physical strength that I used to have and energy that I used to have, but there's a sense of that's okay.
Right, right.
And there's something more than that, and that is Jesus.
Right.
And what he offers in life. And I don't think I'm going to get to the end of my world and say, all this came to nothing. All this is, I'm just despair. Because what I've gained is something that's really good. It's wisdom. It's understanding. It's a right relationship to God. It's an understanding of truth and reality, which is really, really substantive.
Yeah, that.
So So don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, Jack.
Right. No, I don't disagree with you at all. That we acquire...
You don't disagree with me at all. Do you agree with me strongly?
I agree with you strongly.
Thank you.
Yes. As disciples of Jesus, we acquire a taste and learn to delight in things that otherwise we wouldn't delight in. Just the sense that life has meaning and purpose is itself a substantive joy and delight to us. And our existence here is not left dark and gloomy and...
Hopeless.
And hopeless.
It's very hopeful.
It's very hopeful.
Very hopeful.
That's not nothing. I mean, that's an incredible
huge thing. Yeah,
I'm
at the end of... We go through our lives and we get bigger. We get more. More in the sense of more character, more development, more understanding, more maturity, and it's just so much more full. And when I look at this person I was talking about who's in so much despair, and I look at the hopefulness in my life, I rejoice, because that's something really big.
Mm-hmm.
But will I ever have real fulfillment that comes out of everything that I do and every relationship that I'm in? Yeah, that will happen in heaven.
Yeah.
That won't happen here.
Yeah, that's an important point. But what I was driving at, just to contrast the two, I remember once I was a campus worker, a campus minister on a college campus, and coming through town was another campus ministry was bringing a speaker in, and the title of the talks was Maximum Sex. Now, obviously, that's going to appeal to a college audience with being utterly sensual beings, barely above the animals in their instincts and drives. That's going to be very attractive to them. In their minds, maximum sex means maximum fulfillment of animal desire. That's what that means to them. Of course, the message was not that. The message was... come to Jesus, be rightly related to God, and that will introduce a whole new dimension to the relationship between a man and a woman and so on. I mean, I didn't go to the talk, so I'm only going on what I can assume and bits and pieces that I heard. But even there, there's a fallacy involved in the whole premise of that talk, and that is, why do I come to Jesus? I come to Jesus because he will transform the various aspects of this life here and now in the world and make them what they could not otherwise be. Well, there's an element of truth to that, of course. There's an element of freedom that comes when I recognize the true nature of marriage and the true nature of sexuality and the true nature of sexual intimacy. There's some freedom that comes. There's some liberty that comes. There's some... And it can actually enhance the physical experience, undoubtedly. That's true. No question about that. But notice how very unapostolic, non-apostolic the appeal is to basically say to people, the reason you want to become a Christian is so that you can have a better sex life, or that you can have a better sexual experience within the context of marriage even. Is that why I become a Christian? Well, no, it's not. Even if there is some correlation, and even if there is some relationship, that's really not why I come to Jesus. And yet, the overall attitude that you and I think, grew up with was, of course that's why we come to Jesus. I mean, I actually held in contempt the attitude that the reason we would come to Jesus is so that I can have eternal life someday in another time in another place. My whole attitude was, if Jesus doesn't transform this life right here and now, then what good is it? What relevance could it possibly have? And I held in contempt the attitude that is actually the heart of the gospel, namely, the real reason to come to Jesus is so I can be rightly related to the one who can give me eternal life in the age to come.
You know who I think this message has the most immediate and present hope for that we're talking about today are the people who are not experiencing any freedom at all in this life,
mm-hmm.
who have had perhaps very, very traumatic experiences in their life that leaves them only in pain, either psychological or physical pain. And they are like, I guess I think more on the psychological, emotional side, they're like emotional quadriplegics. And they they ask me, does it matter to keep trying when it's so hard, when I don't see any progress? Should I keep walking? And what I often say to these people is, yeah, it does matter. And you need to keep submitting to life because there's something more than what the present reality has for you.
Right.
And I think this is a message they absolutely need, and they need to hear it over and over again, because those same people, they just find no hope when they're taught the message that it ought to get better, that you ought to be happy, that the fulfillment ought to be immediate, that you shouldn't feel like an emotional quadriplegic, that if you were a good Christian, you would be out of that. And so there's attached to that an incredible amount of guilt. I do think people working on emotional things can get better, but some people just live in this eternal hurt emotional state, and that's just where they are. So again, I think this is the most immediate helpful message. I think on the other hand, Jack, the people who are not finding this message very helpful are those who really feel like they have got it together, like they're all their satisfaction is coming from having found Jesus and being up and joyful and spiritual and praising and excited, and you know, their whole life is, you know, exuding this this great mission. Do you know how to explain it better than that? I don't think I'm quite grasping it.
Well, I know the person you're describing. I know the attitude. I was that person at one point. Just this positive joy about how Jesus has come into my life and made it so much better. But look at my circumstances when I'm saying that. Everything is going well. Everything is fine.
Everything's going well. People like me. And that's it. And when somebody comes to them and says, for example, you know, I'm hurting, this is really hard, those people can't relate to the hurting person.
Yeah.
They might say to them, well, when I hurt, what I do is I just go sing. I just go praise the Lord. I just take it to Jesus. I just pray. Well, and that person cannot be a help at all to the person that's hurting. And that person is not going to like this message because they experience themselves as having it all now. But what I would say to them, if that's what your experience is, prepare yourself for the possibility that suffering is going to come into your life. Listen to this tape again and hear that that wasn't what it was all about. I can't tell you how many people I've worked with, Jack, who feel like they've totally fallen off the possibilities for any kind of life because they have lost their, quote, joy.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't hear it now because they really can't see it. And I think it really takes a miracle of God to help somebody who is so up and into this positive way of life that it just seems like that's what all that life is about. Or they're so into trying to make their life only positive that they're not willing to see or gain wisdom from the things that are coming into their lives that are hard.
Right.
And maybe they condemn the people around them who might tweak the possibility that there's something difficult about life, and they might want to flip the channel in listening to us today.
Right, exactly. I think one of the real tragedies, and maybe I'm wrong in my assessment here, and if I am, then forgive me, but as I look at the Christian culture today, it seems to me that, generally speaking, and I'm generalizing, that Christian culture tends to support that notion that there's nothing but joy and peace and satisfaction and fulfillment that comes from a life lived relating to Jesus. And so that the person who is struggling and has lost their joy and is in the pit of despair and is really wrestling with what is my life all about, that there's something spiritually wrong with that person. That if they would just get rightly related to Jesus, then they could be restored to that position of bubbly joy and so on.
Oh, they're thoroughly convinced of that, and being rightly restored to Jesus means to them that they've got to just pray harder, they've got to read their Bible more, they've got to go to church more. And they oftentimes try these things and they still can't kind of pull it together. They still can't get that bubbly, overflowing joy, and then they get really, really scared.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to those people?
What they have to recognize is that they're immersed in a culture, in a church culture that I'm afraid is spiritually sick, is spiritually unbelieving, is in a state of unbelieving blindness, and they need to be willing to forsake that culture for the sake of the truth that the Bible teaches instead. I mean, look at what we do in our culture. We hold seminar after seminar on biblical principles of marriage, biblical principles of economics and dealing with money, biblical principles of management, biblical principles of this, biblical principles of that. And look at all the this's and the that's are things that concern how can I be successful, prosperous, and happy in this world. And if you say to them, well, when I read the Bible, it sure looks to me like what it's emphasizing is our hope for life in the age to come. I think the response you would get is roughly like, oh yeah, that too. But let's go on to what's interesting. That's what I mean by spiritually sick, is if we are spiritually healthy, what will be interesting to us is that ultimate life, that ultimate reward in the world to come. We will have come to recognize that that's really the only thing that has any substance to it, the only thing that's really going to satisfy my life and my existence. This other stuff is just temporary stuff that is the context of my life as I pass through this age. That's all it is, and it doesn't have any substance to it.
Okay, so Jack, what you're doing is you're pointing out our focus, and let me kind of make a distinction here. There could be a conference that was about, say, the biblical principles of marriage. It can lead me to trying to understand just how to be fulfilled in this present age. And that's kind of my focus.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I could have a seminar that's on the biblical principles of marriage, and it can help me come to a greater understanding of how to love.
Mm-hmm.
And that be my goal in life, and it's working itself out through my marriage relationship.
Right.
It's a totally different focus. The latter is very positive. In fact, that is the way through which God trains us, is understanding how we need to approach marriage, for example, and in doing that, in failing and succeeding and working at it, that we come to a greater sense of understanding of ourselves, of the other person, of how to love, of who Jesus is, of what the cross was about our own sinfulness. It is through that channel that we understand it. But very many times what we try and do is sidestep that and try and transcend to kind of this happier reality. If I just do it right, I'm just going to have this perfect marriage. Well, that's a misleading, very, very misleading, and again, puts you in jail kind of way to approach life.
Right, absolutely. And the seminars I've experienced tend to be more of the latter than the former. The one that promises us more than life itself can actually deliver, and certainly more than God has ever promised. And that's what leads me to my assessment that I think we are really not spiritually healthy as a church culture by and large. We're not focused enough on what Christianity itself should be focused on. We don't really believe the gospel, or at least we believe it with a nod of assent, but it's not really important to us. What's really important to us is maybe this Christianity thing can give me an upper hand on succeeding in life. Maybe that's what's really valuable about it. So let me go to some cool seminars that'll tell me how Christianity can help me be really successful in life. That's a really incredibly worldly understanding of things and spiritually unhealthy.
So the non-worldly perspective of the Bible is God is saying to us through the apostles, I want to give you a new character. And this new character is going to come through the mundane experiences of life, the kind of choices you make from day to day in your relationships, in your work.
Yeah, exactly. And why is that important? Why is it important to have that character developed? Because it means you're a child of God who will one day be welcomed into the kingdom of God, where you will have your existence truly and substantially fulfilled. That will be an existence well worth living for all eternity.
This character change is an evidence that I'm a believer.
Right.
It is what we've called sanctification in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, Jack, when we started this broadcast...
We
started to review, and I don't know if we even got there, did we? There were 2 points that we made last time, and you had a third one, so... You're going to have to reorient us here. Where are we?
Well, the first, where we started the review was the goal of the goal that my spirituality sets for myself in biblical terms is this thing that we just finished referring to, sanctification, this transformation of my character, this transformation of my understanding, this transformation of my desires, a whole reorientation of my heart. That's the goal rather than fulfillment. Whereas in folk Christianity, the goal is perceived to be actually fulfillment here and now in this life. Come to Jesus and he'll fill me up. That's one difference. Second difference is that folk Christianity tends to see my achieving that goal by means of a series of or individual or a series of experiences that I have that are extraordinary in their nature. Biblical Christianity, I'll come back to that in a second. Biblical Christianity, it seems to me, sees the goal of my sanctification as being achieved through the everyday, ordinary, mundane, nitty-gritty affairs of my life. I face over and over again choices, whether I either choose this or I choose this. I choose integrity or I choose to be fraudulent. I choose to be faithful or unfaithful, loving, unloving, kind and compassionate, unmerciful and unforgiving. Over and over again, life just confronts me with these choices, and it's in those choices that my sanctification is accomplished. It's by...
that my character is built.
Yeah, it's by defining my character through the choices that I make in life that God, by his grace, is sanctifying me and making me into that person who is qualified for the kingdom of God.
And it is in that character building that there is the fulfillment of life.
Yeah, and that in of itself is a kind of fulfillment. Whatever the degree of fulfillment that we can have in this lifetime
comes from
my recognizing what a substantive person I'm becoming and the delight I feel at having there being some substance to my being.
The delight I feel in the ground that's solid that I stand on.
Right.
And the reality that I can see that I don't have to torque to make different, but I'm looking at reality clearly, and that is the essence of emotional health.
Right. The other day I was thinking, if I just had a magic wand that I could wave over people that only worked once, that allowed me to change one thing about them, I'm believing that what I would use it to do would be to transform their thinking about what they want here and now. The one thing that seems to have been true of our fathers and grandfathers and mothers and grandmothers that doesn't seem to be true of us as a generation is that we don't have an iota of a taste for the joy of the substance of obedience and duty. We can't. Duty is completely a dirty word to us. Obedience is completely a dirty word. It speaks of slavery and phoniness and artificiality and inauthenticity. We don't have a clue. We don't seem to have a clue that a person could be a servant and could be obedient and could be dutiful authentically, out of their heart, because it's who they are, because it's what they want to be, because it's the way they want to define their existence, and that they could actually be fulfilled doing that. They could actually be delighted that they are the kind of person who would do what they're supposed to do. So instead, we ask ourselves, am I happy? Which translates into a whole other concept in our culture. You know, we would never think of doing our duty as making me happy. Our quest is not, I want substance to who I am. Our quest is, I want something that will make me happy. And we're on the wrong quest. We're headed in the wrong direction. I was talking to one of my colleagues the other day who remembers reading an interview with Bob Dylan, Saint Bob. And the interviewer asked him, are you happy being a rock star and so on and so forth? And according to my colleague, Dylan's answer was, what does happiness have to do with it? And he's a very perceptive person, regardless of what you think of his
maybe he is
Saint
Dylan.
Well,
that's a pretty great answer.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that he's not. You know, I mean, I just think that captures so well that that's true of my own life. I've recognized as I reflect on my life, I don't really ask myself the question, am I happy? the question that's more vital to me, the source of satisfaction that I get in life, is that I'm where I'm supposed to be, that I'm becoming what I'm supposed to be becoming, that what I want to be is what God wants me to be. To the extent that that is in conformity, there's a real sense of delight that comes from that, a real sense of peace, a sense of solidity, a sense of substance that comes from that, that is the only satisfaction that we really can hope for in this life. That doesn't make me happy. There's a lot about my existence that makes me very unhappy. But in the midst of that unhappiness is the sense of solidity. And that's not nothing. That's pretty significant.
As you're
but
talking,
I digress.
Here we are. We're digressors, Jack. I think if people have listened to us long, they probably know that we are king and queen of digression. That could be our name, the Digressive Show. I was just thinking, Jack, reflecting as you were saying that on my own life, and I, you know, do I work at making myself happy? Is that really my goal now? Or do I have something bigger in mind? Do I want to be a person that's following God, that really wants to do what's right? Because I think that's what you mean by being obedient and doing my duty. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's not because I decided one day to say I'm just not going to pursue just being happy, but I got more and more convinced over time that that's really the direction I wanted to go in. I wanted to do what's right, and I wanted what comes out of that. And I think usually that's my focus. But I think people can very quickly jump to the conclusion of, oh, now I can never do anything that's fun, or never I can do anything that will make me happy. And I don't think that's the direction you're going in. It's very possible that I can be doing what's dutiful, what's right, what's obedient, and be driving a four-wheeler across my father's ranch and loving it. Because maybe at that point in my life, it's just a good time for me to slow down and relax, have an R&R, because I've been working really hard and I need to regain, this is, for example, my own life, I need to kind of slow down and regain some strength, some space in my head, some clarity, and then I can go back and serve people in a really big way that I often do. For me to say, okay, I can't pursue doing anything that's enjoyable is not part of what you're talking about.
Right. No, not at all.
That makes it too easy. And I think we jump to that. We make a black and white answer that says, okay, now anything I do that does make me happy is now selfish and wrong and not dutiful, and I better just strap myself into submission to always be unhappy.
Right, right.
So
no.
Could you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, in fact, one of the other papers that I delivered at the conference that you referred to was on Kierkegaard, and I think Kierkegaard is just very perceptive in this particular issue. In a nutshell, I think what he says is, it's really only the believer of all people who can get true delight out of all the things, all the serendipitous little joys that this world can bring to us. We of all people are the ones who can enjoy them, because we don't expect to find any meaning from them. We don't derive the meaning of our existence from driving across a ranch in a four-wheeler. Mm-hmm. We just take it for what it is, a really delightful experience, one of the good gifts that God has given us, one of the joys of the world that God has created for us. And since we don't demand from it that it define the fulfillment of my existence, it can just be a really happy time.
Bingo.
For us.
You know, you just really hit it, Jack.
I mentioned this in the conference, that the thing that dramatized this as much as anything for me was the movie Chariots of Fire that came out years ago, if you remember that movie.
Yes.
It was a movie about some runners in England who won some medals in the Paris Olympics in 1920-something, or I don't remember the date.
Way back there.
And one of them was a Presbyterian missionary, Eric Little. Another of them was a guy named Harold Abrahamson, who was a Jew. And Harold Abrahamson ended up winning a gold medal in the 100 meter, and Little won a gold medal in something else. I think it was 200 meter or something like that. But Little had gone to Paris to run in the 100 meter along with Harold Abrahamson, but they scheduled it on the Sabbath, on Sunday, the Sabbath, and being a good Presbyterian, he believed that a good Orthodox Presbyterian, he believed that it would be dishonoring to God for him to run on the Sabbath day, the form of work on the Sabbath day, so he refused to run. The meaning of his existence was his right relationship with God. He loved to run. It was the joy of his life, and it was an incredible sacrifice for him, something he'd worked for years and years and years to compete in these Olympics. But because it came into conflict with what he thought was going to be honoring to God, he was willing to give it up completely because he would not violate his relationship with God. He refused to do that. So he was willing to walk away from it and not compete in the Olympics at all. By some political decisions and the providence of God, what they did is simply transfer him to another event and allowed him to run in another event instead. So he did that. He ended up winning the gold medal. Harold Abramson also had been competing to run in these Olympics and had spent his whole life training for this. He won his gold medal as well. But the movie very astutely, I think, captures after they won their medals, Eric Little is just basking in the joy and the delight of the moment. Harold Abramson goes to a bar and gets himself smashed drunk. And I think it's really clear, and by the dialogue, it's very clear why. He has achieved his goal. He has achieved that thing that his whole life had been defined by, and now there was nothing left.
It was done.
It was just empty. There was just nothing. Little, who was willing to walk away from the whole thing because it wasn't ultimately all that important to him, got this gift, this delight, this joy that he could just celebrate, and it would fade. It would be gone tomorrow. Nobody would remember a month from now, but that's okay because that's not the purpose and meaning of his existence. So I think that's what we're talking about, is Eric Little is a good model for all of us as disciples of Jesus. As long as my existence is defined by something that truly transcends my relationship with God and the promises that he's made, if that's the meaning of my existence, that gives me freedom, and I underline the word freedom, that gives me the freedom to take or leave the things in this world, and when I have the opportunity to take them, I can thoroughly enjoy them. I can thoroughly delight in them for what they're worth, not giving them any more worth than they actually have.
Or when I find that they have more worth than they should have. I think you were giving us a couple of weeks ago, you were giving us an example of your response to your children being in soccer and it being too important to you that they get to play more mm-hmm. than they were being allowed to. Mm-hmm. And I think you caught yourself in the situation of, wow, that's becoming too important to me.
Exactly.
It's too much a meaning of my existence. And so I think that's kind of the learning loop that we go through. We don't necessarily make decisions like Eric Little did. We may well defy what's more important to us. We may well run on the Sabbath. And I need to digress here for a minute. It isn't that we think that the Sabbath, keeping the Sabbath in the way he did, is actually the ultimate
right.
way to serve God. But that's what he thought.
That's what he thought.
And
yeah.
So that was his worship to God. That was his commitment to God. So that's how it looked in his life. But do you follow that?
Yeah.
That's his decision.
We'll talk more about that next week. Like,
okay.
Those particular issues of what exactly we do to please God.
Oh,
yeah.
Good. That would be very good to do.
Because
I was thinking, oh, man, we're really missing this one. Anyway, then we have to realize that we goofed. Eric Little kind of figured out what following God was like, what it meant to him, and he went for it. He didn't actually run on the Sabbath and then say, oops, wait a minute, I had my priorities all messed up.
Mm-hmm.
Which is more unusual.
More realistic. Yeah, it's more realistic that we do run on the Sabbath and figure out the mistake that we've made.
Yeah, that's what I do all the time in my life. And it isn't that I don't want to pursue God, it's that I have a lot of learning to do, and I will continue to have a lot of learning to do and a lot of mistakes that I make. I don't go into life saying, I don't think it's right to go into life saying, well, it doesn't really matter if I mess up because, you know, God forgives me anyway. Well, it's true God forgives me anyway, and I'm still not lost if I make the wrong decision, but I have an attitude of wanting to pursue what's right, and lots of times I just find that I have failed.
Right.
And facing into that failure is a pretty huge part of what we as believers need to expect in our lives.
Yeah.
And that's part of spirituality. Last week I had a really hard week, Jack, because I had made a decision in my work that I had really considered, really thought about it, thought it through, looked at some examples from other times that this same kind of decision had come up several times throughout my counseling years. And I made it based on that information and a lot of other information, and I realized that I didn't take the things into consideration. I wasn't really, if I looked underneath, there was something that I could have done that really would have been about following God that I missed. In my best efforts, I completely missed it, and I think I was being self-serving, but I didn't know it. So I need to learn from my failures. So that's part of what is a part of the process of growing up in life. If the goal of my career is that I would do it perfectly, and that becomes the meaning of my existence, that I always do it right, then that's a huge error of my life.
Right, right.
And that's where I'm always going to fall. But if the meaning of my existence is to try and grow up through my counseling work that I do, not just help other people grow, but help me grow up, then it puts a whole new light on my failure last week.
Mm-hmm.
I can fail, and that is the place through which I can grow.
And I would say that's true of our whole lives, not just our vocations, but our whole lives.
Sure. It's just very poignant last week.
Really. Yeah. A big mistake that I made early on as a Christian, and a lot of people make, is that they really do think that the legitimate goal to set for themselves is to get through the Christian life, get through the life of faith without making any mistakes. It's unrealistic, it's naive, it's not what it's all about. It is, as you say, all about allowing ordinary life experience to teach me.
So here we are at that time again, at the end of our program, that we ask people for financial contributions so that we can continue the program. I would like to remind you listeners that our budget for this program isn't really large. In fact, we try to keep our expenses pretty low. But to keep it on the air in the several locations that we're on the air now, I believe it's 7 or 8, that it does take some money to buy that airtime. And again, if 50 of you decided to pledge $10 a month, we about meet our costs. We'd like pledges from people or financial contributions from people who are really benefiting from this program, so it feels like it's something you're giving to that is important to you. So here's a letter I'd like to share from somebody who does appreciate and value the program. Dear Jack and Christine, I just want to congratulate you both on your past 4 programs on parenting. It was quite an eye-opener on my own parenting. I am a grandmother and a great also, and I wish I could have heard all this 40 years ago. I also realize we never stop learning, and also how my old nature is so stubborn and sinful that I haven't really changed very much. But you two really bring it right home where the rubber meets the road. You are so special and help all of us when you are so vulnerable on the air and just tell it like it is. I used to feel like I failed so much in my walk with God, but no one said it would be easy. I just can't wait to hear what you will be discussing on future programs. Please, don't leave us now. And I would have to say, you know, I really, really appreciate this kind of letter, as does Jack. And when she says, please don't leave us now, it kind of makes me sad because I'm aware that our funding will probably not cover over, we won't be on the air another couple of years unless we have some significant funding increases. So thank you for considering the possibility of contributing to our ministry.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, would like to order other programs, or want to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, please call us at 541-485-4801. Again, that's area code 541-485-4801. You can write us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And you may also find us on the net at www.mackenziestudycenter.org. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa card. If you desire to support the ministry of Mackenzie Study Center, your gift will be entirely tax deductible.
please mail your check to McKenzie Study Center. Again, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. The telephone number again, 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.